Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
From ABC News, this is Perspective. I'm Derek Dennis. Coming up, the road to the 2024 election, unpacking the Iowa caucuses, looking ahead to the New Hampshire primary in the run-up to Super Tuesday in March.
I guess just to see the colors of people come out, to see what people's priorities are.
A scathing new report on the Uvalde, Texas school massacre, the colossal failure of law enforcement, 77 minutes and 45 rounds fired by the gunman before he was finally confronted and killed.
Their loved ones deserve better.
Shrouded in secrecy, the U.S. Defense Secretary's prostate cancer, why the diagnosis is so sensitive.
Especially if they affect the most famous part of our bodies.
It's all ahead on Perspective. The 2024 presidential primary season officially started this week. First, the Iowa caucuses on Monday, and now Republican presidential hopefuls are turning to New Hampshire. ABC's Brittany Shepherd is in Manchester with a look ahead.
It's blisteringly cold here in Manchester, but that hasn't seemed to impact enthusiasm on the ground from New Hampshire voters. In fact, quite the opposite. Campaign rallies are packed to the brim. The excitement is palpable. And for some, it feels more like a sacred responsibility. Just ask Katherine Johnson from Hanover.
I've driven like 5,000 miles in 3 months, and I haven't left New Hampshire.
One person's name you won't see on road signs is Joe Biden. His name isn't on the ballot due to a big primary calendar shakeup from the DNC. And former presidential candidate Andrew Yang, who is here campaigning for Minnesota Congressman Dean Phillips' primary bid against Biden, sees Biden being MIA as their chance.
The fact that he's going to be a write-in here is an invitation for genuine competition.
But only time will tell if these Granite State voters agree. Brittany Shepherd, ABC News, Manchester, New Hampshire.
Back in Iowa, after the hard-fought and frigid caucuses, former President Trump was the victor, winning by 51%. Ron DeSantis took second, and right behind him, Nikki Haley. Vivek Ramaswamy dropping out after a fourth-place finish. The extreme winter weather in Iowa led to the lowest turnout in years. The question is, why is this first-in-the-nation contest so impactful? ABC's Sherry Preston spent all week in the Hawkeye State and says folks in Iowa take these caucuses very seriously.
The blizzard that blew into Iowa the weekend before voting was followed by brutal, frigid temperatures, the wind chill hovering about 29 below. But in the days leading up to the caucuses, the candidates showed up. Nikki Haley in Iowa City.
We're going to stop the wasteful spending and get our economy back on track.
Donald Trump in Indianola.
So brave the weather and go out and save America, because that's what you're doing.
Ron DeSantis in Cedar Rapids.
I'm asking for your support on Monday night.
And Vivek Ramaswamy in Waterloo.
We need somebody with sharp elbows who's willing to break glass when necessary.
The GOP presidential candidates logged thousands of miles and spent tens of millions of dollars going from pizza smorgasbords to pubs to churches, pitching their message to small crowds of Iowa voters. But why? Why do we pay so much attention to this state in the middle of the country every presidential cycle? The answer could be as simple as
tradition!
Yeah, so there's no great answer to that question, except that sometimes history is weird.
Rachel Payne Caulfield is a political science professor and the creator of the Iowa Caucus Project at Drake University in Des Moines. She says it was only after the 1968 Democratic Convention, when powerful political bosses ruled things and activists protested the Vietnam War and the entire process, that things changed.
The Democrats got together after that convention and they said, we really have to fix our process. We have to figure out how to make this a more inclusive, more quote-unquote democratic process.
That first year after 68, in 1972, a relatively unknown politician named George McGovern campaigned here with its quirky tradition of caucusing, meeting voters one-on-one, and surprising many, came in second. He gained enough momentum after Iowa to become the Democratic nominee, eventually losing badly to Richard Nixon. But 4 years later, Iowa was still first, and a peanut farmer governor from Georgia named Jimmy Carter staked it all on this state, and he went on to win.
I told you I didn't intend to lose.
People started paying attention, and Iowa became known as the place that might not pick a winner, but by winnowing the field, might change the course of a campaign. One reason they like it here so much, it's pretty cheap.
Iowa's a state without a huge media market. It's a state where you can travel around very easily and meet with voters very easily.
ABC's Kendall Ross has been doing the same thing as the candidates for the past 7 months. They're an embedded reporter, meaning they follow a certain candidate on the trail every step of the way. Kendall, who grew up in Baltimore and attended NYU, was assigned by ABC News to cover Vivek Ramaswamy. And at first,
it was a bit of a culture shock, you know, especially as a black queer person.
Kendall's questions about the process are the same as much of the rest of the country.
But something I did learn is that people here really do take it very seriously. I don't know if you'll find that in New York City, if anyone is going to spend their Friday night at a pizza ranch or, you know, wherever to listen to a presidential candidate.
At a Grimaldi's Pizza in Ankeny, Iowa, north of Des Moines, voter Zeb Carpenter came to hear Vivek Ramaswamy and paid attention to what he had to say.
I guess just to see the colors of people come out, to see what people's priorities are, what people want to say, who they want to talk to, who they believe in.
So how does a caucus actually work? You have to arrive at one of 1,600 precinct locations around the state at a certain time. I was at the Ankeny Baptist Church on Monday night alongside Brian Baker, who had just moved back to Iowa from Washington, D.C.
I do think it's kind of a surprising thing that Iowa still does, but I mean, it's part of why I'm here, because it is different and unique.
More than 200 people showed up. Well, they were checked in, given little white slips of paper, then they sat down. Eventually, four people got up and spoke for 5 minutes each. One for Donald Trump, one for Ron DeSantis, one for Nikki Haley, and one for Vivek Ramaswamy. After that, everybody took out their slips of paper, borrowed pens from one another, and wrote down their choice. The slips of paper were collected in a Tupperware bowl, taken to the front of the church, and counted. At the Ankeny, Iowa Baptist Church Caucus, Ron DeSantis won 92 votes, Trump 71, Haley 53, Ramaswamy 16, and Ryan Binkley got one. The whole process took 50 minutes. There are 3 million people in the state of Iowa, and only about 110,000 of them showed up for this first-in-the-nation contest.
Do I think that Iowa is representative of the rest of the country? No, I don't. Over my time here, though, I wonder how you justify that. How do you find somewhere where people will actually be engaged?
Iowa really features hardcore people who are motivated to come out on a cold winter night because they care. We never claim to kind of decide the nominee for the whole country. It's really national media that has put this focus on Iowa.
Something else that could drastically change the Iowa political landscape is Donald Trump did not show up for those face-to-face meet and greets with voters. He flew in, held a handful of rallies, and flew out. He also won a resounding victory. Some wonder if that will turn the whole caucus process on its head. For this year, though, Iowa has voted. New Hampshire's next, and the tradition continues. Reporting for Perspective, I'm Sherry Preston, ABC News, Des Moines, Iowa.
Coming up, some answers after the 2022 massacre in Uvalde, Texas, on Perspective, after this.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to Perspective from ABC News. I'm Derek Dennis.
I told the families gathered last night what I hope is clear among the hundreds of pages and thousands of details in this report. Their loved ones deserve better.
Attorney General Merrick Garland, not mincing words, detailing a Justice Department report on the deadly 2022 school shooting in Uvalde, Texas, where 19 students and two teachers were killed. ABC's Jim Ryan on the report's findings and his visit to Uvalde again this week, talking to many who are still heartbroken, frustrated, and angry.
In the 20 months since the massacre at Robb Elementary School, an hour hasn't passed that Kimberly Rubio hasn't thought about her daughter Lexi, one of 19 children murdered on May 24, 2022. She was reminded again this week when U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland came to Uvalde with a phone book-sized report under his arm detailing the police response to the school shooting. She's angry that most of the police officers dispatched to the school were not named.
My daughter didn't receive any training that day. She didn't do anything wrong. She is listed in this report because she is dead. If she doesn't have the right to privacy, why do these individuals have the right to privacy?
The police commanders named in the report have not yet responded to it. Hundreds of law enforcement officers waited more than an hour to take action while an 18-year-old gunman opened fire on classrooms 111 and 112 at Robb Elementary School. In April of last year, the DOJ said it had conducted or reviewed more than 200 interviews and studied nearly 13,000 pieces of evidence related to the police response to the massacre. The conclusion, says A.G. Garland,
the department's review concluded that a series of major failures, failures in leadership, in tactics, in communications, in training, and in preparedness, were made by law enforcement lawyers and others responding to the mass shooting at Robb Elementary.
A major lapse came in the decision to treat Robb as a barricaded person situation instead of an active shooter.
That failure meant that law enforcement officials prioritized a protracted evacuation of students and teachers in other classrooms instead of immediately rescuing the victims trapped with the active shooter. It meant that officials spent time trying to negotiate with the subject instead of entering the room and confronting him.
The DOJ report is well over 500 pages, but Garland says the summary is brief.
The law enforcement response to the mass shooting at Robb Elementary was a failure.
He blames a lack of training, leadership, and coordination for a police response that's been almost universally met with consternation. His hope is that the report becomes a training manual for how not to handle a school shooting.
Part of the reason we did this report is to make sure people all over the country know what the right thing to do is and the right way to do it.
It's a hope echoed by Javier Casares, father of 9-year-old victim Jackie Casares.
This is, we're hoping this does start, you know, chain effect, because there was failure in different, you know, organizations that day from the top to the bottom.
The failures in leadership and communication breakdowns did not end with the death of the gunman. Among the most surprising findings of the DOJ probe is that the crime scene was compromised, meaning that someone outside of an authorized law enforcer was allowed into the school after the smoke had cleared. What's more, says Associate Attorney General Vanita Gupta,
at one point, hours after the shooting, an official incorrectly told families waiting for their children at the Civic Center that an additional bus of survivors was coming. It did not.
As some call for criminal charges against police officers involved in the response, civil suits are all but guaranteed. Attorney Josh Koskoff is representing 17 families of Robb Elementary students and victims.
Where's the government investigation on how this kid got this firepower? The other thing that happened is he ordered over 1,700 rounds of ammunition from an online ammo dealer. How could that happen? Where's the investigation into that?
Regardless of the findings of the DOJ report, Kimberly Rubio knows she'll think about her daughter Lexi again tomorrow, but
I hope that the failures end today.
The Justice Department report on the Robb Elementary School response may in fact help to improve police training against future tragedies like the one here. But for families who lost loved ones, the process of recovery is only beginning. For some, it might never be done. Reporting for Perspective, Jim Ryan, ABC News, Uvalde, Texas.
A plea this week from Ukrainian President Zelensky to Western governments. Keep the military aid coming, or Russia could finally get the upper hand once and for all. But here in the U.S., many lawmakers in Congress seem to have grown tired of helping out Ukraine again and again. House Speaker Mike Johnson.
What is the end game and the strategy in Ukraine? How will we have accountability for the funds? We need to know that Ukraine would not be another Afghanistan.
ABC's Tom Soufie-Burridge is in Kyiv this week and has been talking to Ukrainians on the front lines. He talked about the challenges on our daily podcast, Start Here, with guest host Ann Flaherty.
Tom, let's start with the current state of fighting there right now. What is it that you're seeing on the ground?
Well, and we were sort of near the fighting quite recently. When you get close to the front lines, you can hear it. We also visited a medical stabilization point. I mean, that is a kind of makeshift, very simplistic hospital in a secret location because they're worried that it could be targeted by the Russians. Just back from the front lines. What are the typical injuries you're seeing?
I would say the majority is fragment wounds of the limbs. We have a lot of soldiers stepping on the landmines.
The chief doctor there basically said to us that he has seen 15,000 casualties in the entire war, and he's basically become numb by everything.
I think that the consequences of this I will see in like a couple of years after the war ends, if I survive.
And we went to a major trauma hospital just a few hours west of there, so away from the fighting. And doctors there told us they're seeing a 30% rise in casualties now, heavily wounded soldiers coming through their doors compared to just a few weeks ago. So I think, you know, casualties for the Ukrainians are mounting. What's happened in the last few weeks is the Russians have, I think, retaken the initiative. They have way more firepower, and Ukrainian soldiers are telling this time and time again. The Russians have more artillery ammunition, more drones, and we're talking about lethal explosive drones, which are kind of flown on kind of single journeys at a target. And the Russians have way more of those deadly drones, and we're seeing the impact of that in those rising casualties.
So tell us about this arms production facility that you went to.
Well, the Ukrainians are definitely, and I think this has taken added urgency because of the deadlock between the Biden administration and Congress over additional funding for the war here in Ukraine. And really, people have got to realize the funding that has been approved by Congress is pretty much running out. And that's what the White House is saying now. On the ground in Ukraine, there's been this impetus over the last few months to build up Ukrainian arms production. And I think that's taken on this added urgency now.
Well, we're on a test drive of a Ukrainian armored infantry vehicle, and Ukraine is really ramping up its arms production.
We went inside a series of warehouses, a secret location.
All of these boxes along here, there are mortar launchers, are there?
Yep.
The company, a Ukrainian company called Ukrainian Armor, which manufactures mortars, mortar shells, armored vehicles, and trucks for carrying missile launchers. They spread their production very thinly over multiple sites because what we've seen in those missile attacks you mentioned at the top from Russia is that they are trying increasingly to target Ukrainian arms manufacturing sites. But they are ramping up production.
The military production is booming, not only in quantities, booming in quantities, but also extending the product range.
As in you're producing more military equipment and different types.
Different
now.
Types, and we extend and we adapt to the conditions of the war.
The problem is that Ukraine is starting from a much lower base than Russia. And I think at the moment in the war, we're really seeing the fact that, you know, ever since Vladimir Putin first became president of Russia, and that's 24 years ago, you know, Russia has been building up its military. And yes, lots of Western officials have said, well, Russia's missile stocks are running low because they fired so many throughout the course of this long war. But I think in the autumn, what we've been told by Ukrainian officials is that the Russians were stockpiling missiles. We're seeing that now from their recent attacks. And the Russians just simply have way more military might, way more firepower, and way more capacity to build arms and produce weaponry. And that is a major challenge for the Ukrainians, which they're trying to address.
So then what happens if the U.S. doesn't reach an agreement and the money dries up, the support from overseas dries up?
Well, we're already seeing the fact that Ukrainian artillery units, we visited an artillery unit a few miles back from the front lines in a position where they were firing from.
Well, you can really feel the force of this American gun. But these Ukrainian artillery units are now having to limit the amount they fire.
The commander showed us their sort of stash of artillery shells, US supplied, and they had about 20 shells. And he said during the summer, when the Ukrainians were on the offensive, they would have about 150, 160 shells. So it's a massive, massive reduction. They're having to limit how much they fire. Ukrainian officials are telling me this, that sometimes they're chatting to troops on the ground, and the troops are saying, where is the ammunition. And they are limited. They can't give cover to Ukrainian infantry, which is a massive, massive thing. So we're already seeing the impact. Although the shortage of artillery shells is also down to the fact that the West overall isn't producing enough artillery shells for this war and for the demand more generally. Israel has taken some of the American stock as well.
ABC's Tom Sufi Burridge with guest host Ann Flaherty on Start Here. Coming up, fact versus fiction, the influx of asylum seekers at the southern border, and the myths surrounding them. Plus, a new state law that gives law enforcement the authority to arrest migrants for crossing over. On Perspective, after this.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
From ABC News, this is Perspective. I'm Derek Dennis. Ahead, a reminder to never give up from a Hollywood star. But first, the migrant crisis at the southern border has Texas taking matters into its own hands. A new law set to go into effect this spring makes migrants subject to arrest and deportation for crossing over. And that could mean migrants being separated from their families, even their own children. ABC's Maria Elena Salinas reports on Nightline.
Araceli has lived in El Paso, Texas for nearly three decades, since she was brought over by her parents when she was 11 years old. She and her husband have two businesses and a home in the border town. Her husband and their three children are U.S. citizens, but Araceli, she lives her life in fear.
They say, Mom, but you grow here. You are from here. But I don't feel like... Because when I go to my check-ins appointments, the people there, they treat you different.
Even though you've been here since you were a child, 28 years, yes. You still feel like this is not your city?
Yes.
Araceli asks that we don't show her face, since she is still in the process of getting legal status, a process that has lasted nearly 20 years and involves check-ins with federal officials every 2 months.
Every year you live in limbo, and every year you don't know if the following year you're going to be deported.
Yes.
How does that affect the dynamic of your life and your family life?
It's very insecure. You don't know what's gonna be tomorrow. I tell my kids that anytime they can deport me.
And now, a new state law could make Araceli's situation even more complicated. Senate Bill 4, or SB 4, makes it a state crime to cross the Texas-Mexico border illegally, authorizing local law enforcement to arrest and detain some migrants, and also gives state judges the power to order some migrants removed from the U.S., an authority that currently only the federal government has. Those caught and prosecuted could face up to 6 months, while repeat offenders could face a second-degree felony and up to 20 years in prison. The law prohibits police from arresting migrants in public or private schools, places of worship, and healthcare facilities. Governor Greg Abbott signed the bill into law just last month, and it's scheduled to go into effect on March 5th. But it's already become a flashpoint among activists and politicians across the state and in Washington. The law comes as Texas struggles to deal with a record number of migrants at the border. In fiscal year 2023, there were more than 2.4 million migrant encounters at the southern border, the highest number ever recorded. Representative David Spiller is one of the authors and co-sponsors of SB4.
We're not going after people under SB4 that have been here
3 years, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. We're not going after someone's grandmother that's been here 50 years. That's not the purpose of SB4. We're trying to combat the problem that we have on the border.
But so far, the law has created a lot of fear and confusion.
The proponents of SB4 claim that this law is meant for recently arrived immigrants, not people who have been here for more than 2 years. In practice, is that accurate?
Absolutely not. I would say to them, you should have done a better job writing that law. It applies to every single person in the state of Texas, no matter how far away or close they are to the border, who does not have lawful status or proof of lawful status at the time they're stopped by law enforcement.
Jennifer Babayi provides legal support to migrants through Las Americas, one of the groups legally challenging the law. She is concerned how this law could impact her clients like Araceli.
Araceli does have a reason to be afraid. When we talk to her, we understand and we appreciate why getting in a car and going on the highway where there are police would be terrifying. Because why should she trust that that police officer would understand the complexity of her case and not punish her and put her in jail and separate her from her family?
Are you worried that if SB4 goes into effect on March 5th, like it's scheduled to, that you could be detained and deported?
Yes.
Is there anything that you can do about that?
No, I can't do anything because the only ones that have the rights, because like I said, this is not my country.
What do you want to say to Governor Abbott and the legislators that approved this law?
We're all humans and we all have feelings and family.
That was ABC's Maria Elena Salinas on Nightline. Curbing the surge of migrants is a hot topic on the presidential campaign trail. Republicans have been taking a hard-line stance, demanding more security at the border, blocking any more funding for Ukraine until changes are made. But Democrats want changes too. Many say the entire immigration system should be revamped. ABC News contributor and former Homeland Security official John Cohen says a big part of the problem is politics and the rhetoric and myths that come with it, including the suggestion that the Biden administration isn't doing much.
Yeah, I mean, I can say on a firsthand basis that this is an issue that occupies the time of the senior leadership of the department. I've personally been in meetings at the White House, and in no time did I ever hear anybody say, hey, let's open up the border and just let people pour across it and not do anything. But typically, on any given day, CBP and our border resources can handle about 3,500 encounters each and every day. When you experience 12,000 people every day, you have to adapt and you have to adjust and you have to surge additional resources. And unfortunately, congressional inaction has made that very difficult.
And another myth that building a wall will solve things?
Barriers in some spots can help. But if you're talking about the flow of illegal drugs into the country, those drugs are flowing in through ports of entry, in Pacific transit zones. Traffickers will fly drugs over any barrier or they'll tunnel under them. So diverting resources away from enforcement programs so you can build a border wall just compounds the issue. And quite frankly, that's one of the reasons why we're experiencing the situation that we're experiencing today.
And what about this talk that we're hearing of mass deportations and closing the border altogether? Are those solutions that are realistic?
No, they're not realistic at all. If we actually put money into deporting every person here that is in an unauthorized or undocumented status, law enforcement would be doing nothing else. We wouldn't be stopping terrorists. We wouldn't be dealing with day-to-day crime. But the other part of the equation is that we rely on migrant labor, including labor by people who are here in an unauthorized or undocumented status, to fuel key parts of our economy. You know, this is why this is such a complicated issue.
So bottom line it for us, is this a funding issue? Is this a policy issue? You know, where do we go with the migrant crisis at the border?
We need people at the border who are going to process these individuals, who are going to screen these individuals, who are going to adjudicate their claims. We need transportation resources. We need housing resources. And it doesn't all need to be at the border. We should have a plan on how we're going to move people off the border and into the interior. And if they're going to be here for a considerable period of time because of the backlog in our immigration system, we should be thinking about providing temporary work authorization. But at the end of the day, we also need to make sure that terrorists and criminals and illicit drugs aren't entering the country. The problem is, The current political situation prevents all of that from occurring. We're not having serious discussions from a public policy perspective. And as a result, CBP and the men and women who risk their lives each and every day to protect our southern border are under-resourced.
ABC News contributor and former Homeland Security official John Cohen. Coming up, a candid conversation about prostate cancer and the privacy surrounding Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin's recent diagnosis, why many men don't want to talk about it, on Perspective, after this. You're listening to Perspective from ABC News. I'm Derek Dennis. An important conversation is happening around prostate cancer in men, especially black men, after Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin's recent diagnosis and the time he took to disclose it. Just listen to this 911 call that came out this week, where a staffer could be heard calling for an ambulance to arrive at the secretary's home earlier this month.
Is he reporting any chest pain at all?
No.
He's awake, he's alert and oriented, he's not confused or anything like that, correct?
Correct. Can I ask, but can the ambulance not show up with lights and sirens? We're trying to remain a little subtle.
Yeah, I understand. Usually when they turn into a residential neighborhood, they'll turn them off.
That call was just the beginning. Turns out the secretary's health scare was kept under wraps for days, even from his boss, President Biden. A Pentagon spokesperson apologized for the lack of transparency, and the president is standing by Austin. And we should say, ABC News has not spoken with the defense secretary, so we don't know why he was so private. But we talked about this with ABC News correspondent Steve Osunsami. He's a prostate cancer survivor, and he says there are very personal and very common reasons many men keep this kind of diagnosis a secret.
I paid very close attention to this story because I lived it. I was diagnosed with prostate cancer in 2012. I was young at the time. I was to be diagnosed with prostate cancer. I was 41 years old.
And your cancer was pretty advanced.
I had stage 3. So that meant that I'd had it when I was 40, but I forgot to do my physical that year, so I didn't find it.
And your PSA test results were off the chart?
Anything above a 4 puts you in the danger of like, oh, shoot, we got to test for cancer. Mm. I was a 21.
Really?
Yes. 21.
Wow.
How this relates to the secretary, to the defense secretary, is there's a lot of similarities here. Men, in general, I think you might agree with me on this, are not the best at talking about illnesses and diseases, especially.
You call it the most famous part of our bodies.
Absolutely. Especially if they affect the most famous part of our bodies, I've heard it described as the fragile male ego. That may be part of it, but men just are weird about talking about anything related to, you know, that sort of, you know, organ. And I think especially among black men.
And you know this because of a secret you uncovered in your own family?
The doctor who saved my life, she'd been asking me all these questions, like, what's your family history? And at that point, I did not believe that there was any prostate cancer in my family, because all I had been told, I knew I had one grandfather on my father's side who died when my dad was young. I had been told that he died of a heart attack. You know, we're talking about a black man, and in this case, also an African man. And so I'm telling this to my doctor. And God bless her, she knew enough about the culture and the gender issues here to not believe me 100%. And what I ended up discovering very quickly in talking with my dad and talking with other family on his side is that my grandfather, you know, they ended up saying that he died. It was a drawn out death. That was the first clue.
Mm.
It wasn't an instant death. It wasn't a heart attack that killed him instantly. It was a drawn-out death. And then the sensitive part, they were saying that he had trouble with bathroom issues, trouble using the bathroom, trouble holding his water. There was that sort of trouble. And that was like, oh, okay, folks, this was prostate cancer. Plus, my grandfather was the same age as I was when I was being diagnosed. So it all just made sense.
And Steve, you know this. Prostate cancer, unlike many other cancers, is just different. Lung cancer, stomach cancer, skin cancer, they're just more talked about. Patients are more public about those cancers.
Prostate cancer, you know, it just in among men, especially Black men, there's an embarrassment or weirdness about it that shouldn't be there, but is. Even if you think you don't have a family history, if you can get your doctor and your insurance to pay for the blood test for prostate cancer, it's not a bad idea to get that test. That's the key.
You know the statistics here. Prostate cancer, the most common cause of cancer among men. 1 in 8 men get it. 1 in every 6 African-American men diagnosed with prostate cancer in their lifetime. So, you know, in all of this, what's the lesson? Not just for men, but Black men.
There's a couple things. Even though it's uncomfortable, even though you're embarrassed by it, even though you're concerned about it, even though you're frightened about it, it's better for, frankly, for your family, for people, for men to be better about talking about this. Now, one of the reasons why men are so sensitive about this is because, in addition to, you know, that famous organ, it's because most men kind of know that if you have prostate cancer, the treatments to prostate cancer can greatly affect a man's sexual abilities, performance, sexual function, and also ability to hold water. And that adds to why men don't want to talk about this. For most men, their number one fear isn't whether they'll die. It's about sexual function.
That's so interesting. That's so interesting.
That's going to be high on the list. But the minute you can get him talking about that, the minute you can get him admitting that he's concerned about sexual function, he's concerned about his ability to hold water, and of course he's concerned about death, then you're going to get more conversations about what's happening, how the treatment's affecting him. You know, there's a whole mental side to this. You know, men don't like to admit that they're afraid of this.
ABC News correspondent Steve Osunsami and the silence around prostate cancer. The defense secretary is back on the job, working remotely while he recovers from his cancer treatment, but the questions continue. The House Armed Services Committee has asked the secretary to testify before lawmakers next month about his decision not to disclose his recent hospitalization to the White House. Before we go, a moment this week that highlighted the power of believing in yourself, even when the road is long and hard. 53-year-old actress and comedian Niecy Nash-Betts won her first Emmy as Best Supporting Actress for her role in the Netflix series Dahmer, Monster, The Jeffrey Dahmer Story. Of course, she's been in Hollywood for years as a television and film star, but says even with all of her credits, as a Black woman, she still struggled for acceptance, validation, and recognition, never fully getting her due. Listen to what she told the crowd in her rousing Emmy acceptance speech.
I'm a winner, baby! Thank you to the Most High for this divine moment. Thank you, Ryan Murphy, for seeing me. Evan Peters, I love you. Netflix, every single person who voted for me, thank you. And my better half who picked me up when I was gutted from this work, thank you. And you know who I wanna thank? I wanna thank me. For believing in me and doing what they said I could not do. And I wanna say to myself in front of all you beautiful people, go on, girl, with your bad self. You did that.
Nash-Betts said she cried many nights, for years even, because she wasn't being seen for certain types of roles, and said her perseverance came at a tremendous personal cost. But she's a winner now. Her message, never give up. From ABC News, this has been Perspective. Thanks for listening. This show is produced by Aaron Ferrer, Marwa Muwaki, and Joy Piazza. If you want to listen to any of our past shows, subscribe to the Perspective podcast. give us a review. If you've got the time, tell us what you'd like to hear in the future and what you think. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find Perspective and other ABC News shows at abcaudio.com/podcasts. For ABC News, I'm Derek Dennis.